Picture this. 1998, the Mojave Desert, a Boeing B-29 superfortress sitting in the open air, cracked paint oxidized down to bare aluminum, windows gone dark, four enormous engines frozen solid from 4 decades of sitting still. Her name is Doc, I'm Taildragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, this one's worth every minute. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, back to Doc. The Boeing B-29 Superfortress. The name is not marketing, it is not exaggeration. She was, in the plainest possible sense of the word, super. The most technologically advanced production aircraft of the Second World War, and I will hold that position against any challenge you want to bring. Think about what she offered her crews. In an era when most heavy bombers required their men to fly at 25,000 feet in open, unheated, unpressurized compartments, oxygen masks mandatory, electric flight suits struggling to keep up, frostbitten fingers working gun controls in temperatures that could hit 40 below zero, the B-29 had a pressurized cabin. A heated forward compartment where you could breathe the air that was right there in the room, not air from a bottle strapped to your back. In 1944, that was close to inconceivable. Add to that the remote-controlled gun turrets. Most bomber gunners of the era were physically in contact with their weapons. A waist gunner standing at an open window in the freezing slipstream. A ball turret gunner folded into a plexiglass sphere below the fuselage. On the B-29, gunners sat inside the pressurized fuselage and aimed through optical periscopic sights, operating gun positions they weren't even standing next to. The weapons moved remotely. It was fire-controlled technology that wasn't supposed to exist yet, and the range. The B-29 could carry a meaningful bomb load from the Mariana Islands to the Japanese home islands and return. 1,500 miles each direction, roughly speaking. No other Allied bomber in the war could come close to that number.
Then there were the engines. Four Wright R-3350, duplex cyclone engines, each developing over 2,000 horsepower at takeoff, 18 cylinders per engine arranged in two banks of 9, rotating around the crankshaft in a massive circle. Each engine drove a four-bladed propeller that was 16.5 feet in diameter. 16.5 feet, you could land a Piper Cub on one of those prop discs. Combined, those four engines could push a fully loaded B-29 over 100,000 pounds of airplane to 33,000 feet, cruise speed over 220 miles per hour. It was the heaviest production aircraft ever flown to that point in history. Now, here's a fact that stops people cold the first time they hear it. The B-29 development program cost the United States more money than the Manhattan Project, more than the atomic bomb. Both programs ran simultaneously, the bomb and the airplane that would carry it, and the airplane cost more. Because building something that could actually reach Japan and come back required solving engineering problems that nobody had solved before on a timeline that didn't allow for the usual pace of aviation development. Much of that problem solving happened in Wichita, Kansas. Boeing had a plant there during the war that was operating at a pace you have to see in photographs to appreciate. The air capital of the world, Wichita earned that name. Beechcraft, Cessna, Boeing, all building there simultaneously. The B-29 production lines ran around the clock. Day shift, night shift, weekend shift. Nearly 4,000 superfortresses were built during the war, a significant portion of them right there on the Kansas plains, by Kansas workers. Doc, official serial number 44-69972, came off that Wichita production line in 1944. She served in the Pacific after the war. She flew missions again during the Korean War. Then she was transferred to the Naval Air Weapons Station at China Lake in the California desert, where the Navy intended to use her as a static training aid. Something maintenance crews could practice on. She was never bombed. She was never cut up for scrap. She just sat 1956 to 1998, 42 years in the open Mojave air.
The desert is kinder to aluminum than most places would be. The dry air slows corrosion in ways that a coastal environment or the Gulf humidity would not. But 42 years is 42 years. The engines don't care about climate. The rubber components don't care. The wiring insulation doesn't care. Her name came from the crew who painted a cartoon doctor character on her nose during her active days, Bugs Bunny style in the tradition of bomber nose art from the Pacific, Doc. And she sat in the desert, and the world moved on around her. Now here's where it gets interesting. By the late 1990s, the people who paid attention to these things were looking at the global B-29 population and arriving at a number that made them uncomfortable. Out of nearly 4,000 built, one was flying. One, Fifi, operated by the Commemorative Air Force out of Midland, Texas. Fifi is a magnificent airplane, and the Commemorative Air Force does work that matters. But one thread is fragile. Doc was sitting at China Lake going nowhere. The Kansas Aviation Museum took custody of her in 2003. They moved her back to Wichita. She'd been born there. She came home. And what happened next is not the story of a wealthy collector. It's not the story of a government program or a major institution with deep pockets. It's the story of people who showed up. A retired airline captain named Tony Mazzolini stepped forward to lead the restoration effort. Tony wasn't a household name. He wasn't making headlines. He was a pilot and an aviation man who understood what Doc was and what she was worth. He started gathering a team, volunteers mostly, retired airline mechanics who'd spent careers keeping jets flying and now wanted to put their hands on something built before they were born. Former military maintenance people who knew reciprocating engines, the way younger technicians know avionics, sheet metal workers, engine overhaul specialists, structural engineers who donated their weekends, they set up at what is now Dwight D. Eisenhower National Airport in Wichita, and they started the only way you can start, by taking her apart and finding out what they actually had.
Some of it was encouraging. The desert had done its job. More structure was serviceable than they'd feared. But corroded wiring is corroded wiring. Rubber hoses that have been static for 50 years don't spring back to life because you want them to. Hydraulic components, fuel lines, the control cables that run through that enormous fuselage, systems that require inspection before you can know anything, and then there were the engines. The Wright R-3350 had a complicated reputation even in active service. It was powerful, genuinely powerful, but it ran hot, and it demanded active, careful management from the flight engineer on every mission. B-29 engine fires were not a theoretical risk. They happened over the Pacific, in combat, at altitude, and they cost aircraft and lives. The cowl flap design created cooling challenges that crews had to actively manage every hour of every flight. The airplane would go where you pointed it, but you had to respect the engines. Bringing four of those engines back from decades of static storage meant disassembly, inspection, and rebuilding from the inside out. Parts that could be saved were saved. Parts that couldn't were sourced. And sourcing parts for a B-29 in the 21st century means working the network hard. The Warbird community has long memories and deep connections. A call goes out, does anyone have a specific component for a Wright 3350? And the answer might come back from a collection in Ohio, or a retired mechanic in Arizona, or a British aviation museum that has spare components sitting in a crate and knows what they're worth to the right project. That network, built on relationships between people who care about old airplanes, who understand what these machines mean and what it costs to lose them, is one of the things that makes the Warbird world function. It's not just money, it's knowledge passed person to person. Trust built over years, people willing to hand over something irreplaceable, because they believe it'll be used right. 300,000 volunteer hours. 13 years of weekends and evenings and stretches of annual leave and whatever other time people could carve out of their lives. Some of the people who started the project in those early years didn't live to see Doc fly again. They came anyway. They worked, they went home, they came back the next weekend.
Think about what that commitment looks like from the inside. You show up on a Saturday morning. You spend the day on something that probably won't matter until years from now. You go home, you come back, you do that over and over, knowing that the finish line is genuinely far away, knowing you might not reach it, and you do it because the airplane is worth it. Because what it represents is worth it. On July 17, 2016, Doc taxied out from the hangar at Eisenhower National Airport in Wichita, Kansas. The four Wright R-3350 duplex Cyclone engines were running, all four of them lit and running the way they were designed to run. When she rolled onto the runway and the throttles came forward, the sound that came off that airplane reached across the field and hit people in the chest from a quarter mile away. There is no way to fully prepare someone for what four Wright Cyclones at takeoff power sound like in person. A turbine engine sings, it whines and rises, and it's impressive, no question. But four big radials at full song is something entirely different. It's percussive, it hammers. It's the sound of organized controlled explosion happening 18 times per cylinder, per engine, 64 firings per revolution. Four engines, all of it at once. And it doesn't just travel through the air, it travels through the ground under your feet and up through your boots. People who were standing on that ramp described feeling it in their teeth. She rotated, she climbed out over Wichita, the city where she was built, by workers who were mostly gone now, who had run those same production lines and shifts that didn't stop, who couldn't have imagined that 60 years later someone would bring one of their airplanes back to the sky over the same city. She made her passes. She came back around and landed. A lot of people on that flight line were crying. Warbird events produce that kind of moment sometimes. But this was different from a new paint job or a clean restoration of a fighter. This was a four-engine heavy bomber. Built in this city, flown in combat, forgotten for most of half a century, brought back by ordinary people who refused to accept that it was over. That kind of thing earns the tears.
Doc is now operated by Doc's friends, a Kansas nonprofit that maintains and flies her. They take her to air shows around the country, they run ride programs, you can buy a ticket, and actually fly in a B-29. I don't know what's on your aviation bucket list, but if that isn't somewhere on it, reconsider. When you get close to dock on a static display, photographs don't capture what you actually see. The sheer scale of her, the fuselage is the width of an early airliner. The forward canopy is a greenhouse of curved plexiglass panels, each frame holding a view of the sky that the original crews stared through on the way to Japan and back. The bubble turrets on the sides and aft section where gunners sat wrapped in plexiglass scanning the Pacific sky for zeros. The nose art, the cartoon doctor that gave her her name, walk around her slowly. This is the physical object that 1944 touched, the metal that workers' hands formed right here in Kansas, the airframe that flew through Pacific Air decades ago carrying men who were mostly in their 20s, doing a job that the history books have since made sound inevitable, but which at the time felt anything but. And then think about the 300,000 hours that went into giving it back to the world. There are two flying B-29s on Earth right now, Doc and Fifi. Two out of nearly 4,000 built. The next time someone asks you why warbird preservation matters, that's your number, two out of 4,000. And the reason the number is two instead of one is because a group of people in Wichita refused to accept the alternative. That's the restoration story worth telling. Sources today come from the historical record maintained by Doc's friends, the National Museum of the United States Air Force, and the body of aviation history documenting the B-29 program. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Safe flying out there.